I call the House Higher Education and Finance and Policy Committee to order. We do have a quorum, but we will not be approving minutes for this meeting. The next meeting, I think, we'll have three sets of minutes from our meeting on Tuesday night as well. But today we have with us the private colleges, and welcome. So go ahead and state your name and start your presentation.
Madam Chair and Co-Chair Wolgamott and committee members, for the record, I am Paul Cirkvenik, and I serve as the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I am going to give you a short overview of the collective impact of our colleges in Minnesota, and then you'll hear from two of our presidents and one of our students. And we have a second student set up to testify, and he woke up this morning very sick, and his testimony is in writing in your materials. The Private College Council has 18 member institutions, all of which offer bachelor degrees. Five of our institutions offer associate degree programs. Eight institutions offer degree completion programs primarily serving adult learners. And 15 of our 18 institutions offer graduate degree programs. We collectively enroll more than 54,000 students, about 40,000 students in undergraduate programs, and over 14,000 in graduate level programs. One in three Minnesota high school graduates who choose to pursue a bachelor's degree in Minnesota do so at our colleges. Our institutions collectively contribute $4.5 billion in direct, indirect, and induced economic impact in the state. We have 367,000 alumni living in Minnesota, and our employment of more than 12,000 employees makes us collectively the 13th largest employer in the state. 68% of our undergraduate students are Minnesota residents. 25% of our undergrads are Pell Grant recipients, meaning they come from families with incomes generally under $60,000. 33% of our undergraduates are students of color, and 20% are first-generation students. Our institutions work intentionally to be good options for transfer students, who account for 17% of our new student enrollment, the largest share of whom come from Minnesota's community colleges. Our institutions each make their own effort to keep college affordable within the financial constraints they face. They do this by controlling costs and investing in institutionally provided aid, which is the single largest budget item in the budgets of private colleges. For every $1 in state and federal grants to our students, our member institutions award $6 in institutional grants, scholarships, and discounts. As a result, over the last 10 years, our average net tuition for first-year students has remained essentially flat. It was $14,850 in 2013-14, and it was $14,700 in the 22-23 academic year. A priority for our institutions is to help students complete a degree in 4 years whenever possible. Graduating in 4 years helps hold down the cost of college and the level of student debt. Graduating in 4 years also means students can put their education to work sooner. When compared to private colleges in other states, our overall four-year graduation rate of 65% ranks third in the nation. Our 56% four-year graduation rate for Pell Grant recipients ranks second in the nation. Most importantly, the investment students make in their education at our colleges pays off. A recently updated study by the Georgetown Center for Education and the Workforce, which takes into account the actual cost students pay at each institution, determined that the ROI on a degree from our member institutions is more than $2 million over 40 years. The median annual earnings of our alumni working in Minnesota full-time 4 years after graduation is $66,800. And our graduates are filling needs in high-demand occupations in Minnesota. For example, we produce more than one-third of the newly licensed teachers each year, and nearly half of the new teachers of color. In healthcare fields, we produce 37% of the undergraduate and 37% of the graduate healthcare degrees awarded in Minnesota, including 45% of the baccalaureate nursing degrees awarded. Our students and our institutions are deeply grateful for your investment in students through the Minnesota State Grant Program. It makes a college degree possible at all institutions for the students who face the biggest financial barriers to earning a college degree. The shortfall in state grant funding is deeply concerning. If not addressed, this deficit could cause about 24,000 students of the 81,000 eligible students to lose their state grants entirely. And all of the remaining students will have their state grants significantly reduced. Need-based financial aid increases enrollment, retention, and degree completion while holding down student debt. If grants are significantly reduced, over time, Minnesota risks the opposite effects, including a reversal of the welcome trend of increasing enrollments over the last year. State grant investments by the legislature this year will keep a promise students are relying on and will drive future economic success for our state. While recognizing the budget challenges that exist, we hope you will do as much as you possibly can to protect students from reductions in their state grants. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cirkvenik. Any questions at this point? Otherwise, we'll go to the next testifier. Okay, not seeing any. So the president from College of St. Scholastica, President McDonald, is on Zoom.
Thank you very much for allowing me to testify by Zoom. My name is Barbara McDonald, and I have the pleasure of serving as the president of the College of St. Scholastica, located in Duluth, Minnesota. I've prepared some slides, which I hope you can see up on the screen, and I'd like to share our story with you this afternoon, and later you'll be hearing from one of our students, Maddie Plouffe, who serves as the president of our Student Government Association. As I mentioned, this College of St. Scholastica is located in Duluth, Minnesota. It was founded in 1912 by the sisters of the Benedictine Sisters of the St. Scholastica Monastery. They came to Duluth actually in the late 1800s at the request of the bishop, who was the first bishop of Duluth. Even though they're not a diocesan organization, they were asked by the bishop to come up and to help with establishing health care and education. They were the ones responsible for building St. Mary's Hospital, which is now St. Mary's Medical Center, the flagship of the Ascension system, and they served in regional schools. St. Scholastica started as a school for girls and then became a college for women in 1912. We opened our doors to 6 students, and we now serve approximately 3,000 students, half of which are undergraduate traditional students. We offer over 70 programs of study in the forms of majors, minors, certificates, and concentrations. And we reach students not only in Minnesota, but all over the world. About 80% of our students, though, do come from Minnesota, and the majority of them stay in the state after graduation. We started our first nursing program in the early days of the college. Our other programs, early programs, included education, liberal arts majors. Our legacy really is one of our key programs, health information management. Started the first medical records program in the 1930s in the United States with a bachelor's degree in that area. And now hundreds of our students who have graduated since then have gone on to lead organizations and businesses as practitioners, faculty, and many authors of the textbooks that are now used in classrooms to prepare current students. We have the Duluth main campus with the iconic Tower Hall that you can see up on the screen, but we also have a health science campus located in Duluth, as well as a campus in St. Cloud that is devoted to post-baccalaureate nursing and nurse practitioner programs. If we go to the next slide, I just wanted to share with you our mission and values. Our community is definitely driven by our Benedictine values that lead everything that we do. Our founding sisters were strong leaders as professionals, and they served as faculty in schools and in colleges across Minnesota and the country. They served as healthcare providers, administrators, Many were artists, scientists, and researchers. And a fun fact is that the second woman to overnight in Antarctica was a sister who was a dean of the college at the time. We'll go on to the third slide, please. Driven by our heritage and legacy, we provide an exceptional experience for students. Our classes are small. Our students truly feel a sense of belonging, and they're known by their first names. Our student outcomes are such as persistence, retention, and graduation are evident in their success. Nearly 100% are employed or in graduate school within the year that they graduate. They go on to lead very successful lives as leaders in the communities they live in. And I'm constantly hearing from our employers that our students are sought out because they bring not only their skills and knowledge, but a strong sense of our values to their jobs. Some notable facts, if we can go to the next slide, please, include our popular majors, not just healthcare, which is our primary area, but also biology, pre-med, exercise, physiology, business, and education. We have a thriving fine arts program and lots of opportunities for students to participate in interdisciplinary studies. Many of our students, in fact, graduate with double majors and minors. Our students do very well economically with their earnings, exceeding many other Minnesota graduates. CSS default rates on loans has consistently been extremely low and as it is today. We partner significantly with business and industry, and particularly our healthcare partners in Duluth and Greater Minnesota. And we provide significant workforce for rural Minnesota in particular. In 2021, we opened our Center for Experiential Learning focused on internships, early internships for all students, career readiness, and also serves as a place for employers to come and participate in job interviews regularly with our students. I'll go to the next slide, please. A little bit about our graduates. About 60% of our graduates are in the healthcare jobs, from administration to finance to nursing, pre-med, occupational therapy, physical therapy, physician assistant. We host the second largest nursing program in Minnesota. We graduate about 300 bachelor prepared nurses each year. And we play a critical role in Greater Minnesota, especially in the area of Northeast Minnesota, with our graduates serving the Iron Range, the counties of St. Louis, Kuching, Itasca, Carlton, and the St. Cloud area. We have direct relationships with our hospitals that rely on our grads to meet their workforce needs. Not only do we provide support with nursing and other practitioners, our graduates serve in leadership roles as CEOs, senior administrators at institutions such as Aspirus St. Luke's, Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, St. Mary's, Essentia, and many other organizations across Minnesota. Last slide, please. Or actually, second to the last slide. I want to just thank you so much for your support of the state grant. None of this would be possible for our students without the support. The impact is very profound. Our founders were very focused on serving those students regardless of financial abilities, and as you can see, 34% of our students receive state grant funding. That means that our undergraduate students rely heavily on this promise to help support their education, at the same time that we, as Paul mentioned, keep our tuition affordable. The benefits of their experience at a small campus like ours means that they get an excellent education and engage early in their careers. As dependent on tuition to cover our costs, we're extremely nimble at controlling those costs. Our average net tuition is equivalent to students attending public colleges or universities in Minnesota. However, that opportunity, just like with our public higher education partners, is dependent on students receiving support through the state grant program. And we are not in a position to make up for the state grant reductions. And so funding the grant program is absolutely critical to ensure that we can continue to provide the workforce our region so desperately needs. So last slide, please. We are, as a college, St. Scholastica is truly leaning into building a better future for Minnesota, for our students, their families, and our communities. And I just want to take the opportunity to thank you for your support, for your investment in the state grant program, and all your efforts to protect students who rely on this program for their success. And thank you very much for hearing my testimony via Zoom today. We unfortunately have COVID in the household, which meant I was not able to travel down to be with you in person. So thank you so much, Chair Rarick and committee members.
Thank you, President McDonald. Any questions, Representative Coulter?
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question, but I did just want to say that I had the opportunity to visit the campus at St. Scholastic a couple of years ago and see some of their healthcare education facilities. And they are impressive, and I didn't qualify that with even for a private college. They are just generally really, really impressive, and it's really exciting to see what they're doing up there for the healthcare workforce. So just wanted to say that.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. Yeah, it looks like they train an awful lot of folks in the medical field, especially for the Duluth and surrounding area. So being married to a senator that covers Carleton County, I appreciate that. Any other questions or comments from members? Okay, seeing none, we will move forward in the presentation. We have the president from the University of St. Thomas with us. If you would introduce yourself to the committee and start your slide presentation.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and representatives. My name is Rob Fisher. I have the privilege of serving as the president of the University of St. Thomas. It is a real privilege to be with you today, and my overarching message is to express gratitude for all the support you have shown for our students over the decades through the state grant program. So at the University of St. Thomas, we have been educating Minnesotans for 140 years, and our mission dedicates us to form morally responsible leaders who think critically, act wisely, and work skillfully to advance the common good. So what does that mean? It means that we have to be relentlessly focused on the formation of our students as whole persons. I tell our students frequently that, yes, we're going to do a great job at equipping and empowering you to thrive in whatever course of employment you choose, but we really have an aspiration to prepare you for lifelong flourishing. And that means we're going to need you to lift your gaze beyond simply employment readiness. So how do we articulate that? Well, at the first day of orientation and at commencement, as they're about to walk off the stage, I articulate to them what our core aspiration for them is. It is that every student who sets foot on our campus will emerge from their time at St. Thomas with the unshakable knowledge that they are loved, that their lives have purpose, that their work has meaning, and that they have been uniquely gifted to make irreplaceable contributions to our world. So that means that we have to equip them within a supportive network of relationships in all we do. So what does that look like in some practical terms? You may know we're the largest private university in Minnesota. We have 120,000 living alumni, the vast majority of them who live and work in Minnesota. We have 9,400, a little bit more than that, total student enrollment. It's about 6,000 undergrads, between 3,000 and 3,200 graduate students. And then we have, some of you may be familiar with our Doherty Family College, which is a relatively new two-year college for students who otherwise did not have a pathway to a four-year degree. All told, it's about 9,400 students. We reflect Minnesota. 80% of our students are Minnesota residents. 25% are first-gen students, and 1 in 3 rely on state grants. This means that we are committed to helping our students achieve a St. Thomas education in ways that are accessible despite what their own family economic background might be. We do this. Our number one fundraising priority is always student scholarships. We've had some success on that, and we devote everything we can to growing those resources that are available. We also discount our tuition as needed to help make it reachable for our students. And then a key partner for us is the state through the state grant program, empowering and equipping lower income families to choose St. Thomas when it is the best fit for them. In terms of academics, like the College of St. Scholastica, we keep small class sizes. We think that's most conducive for many of our students for their learning and developing relationships that will support their learning. Average class size of 22. All of our classes are taught by faculty. We do not have graduate assistants teaching classes. We want to make sure we're always in the context where professors know their students, the students know their professors, because we know just as much learning takes place outside the classroom as within the classroom. We have been good at pivoting to meet critical workforce needs for Minnesota. We've recently started a College of Health, the School of Nursing. We're very good in the various engineering fields, computer science, exercise science, entrepreneurship, psychology, financial management. We're always, we take seriously this concept of vocation, that we want all of our students to be discerning how their gifts and expertise and life experience and values can best meet the needs of the world around them. And we want to do the same thing institutionally, always. How can we pivot to better adapt to the needs of Minnesota and the surrounding region going forward? We always want to make sure we're delivering a strong value proposition. That means we have to be concerned with outcomes. We do very well on employment. We're a key hiring partner for all the large employers in the state of Minnesota. We want to make sure our students have hands-on experience. The vast majority of our undergrad students successfully complete an internship while they're at St. Thomas. We're big on clinical placements and community service. We want them to be preparing for the workforce long before they cross the commencement stage. We're very proud of our outcomes for students in all majors, and whether the student is a first-gen student or a fourth-gen student or somewhere in between, we do very well on the employment market, and we meet students where they're at, and we equip them to thrive. We're an economic engine for the city of St. Paul, for the Twin Cities Metro, and for the state of Minnesota. So these are, we retained an outside firm to do an economic impact analysis for us last year, and this analysis, it excludes earnings from alumni. Those would be very different numbers. These are just our direct economic impact in these various regions. At the University of St. Thomas, we have over 1,500 full-time employees, and then we spawn just about $1 billion of economic activity a year in the state of Minnesota. And then finally, what's very important for us is that we not just be giving back and contributing to the broader community, but that we are helping form our students in ways where that is just a natural and inescapable part of their education. So we have thousands of students who volunteer every year, over 100,000 hours of volunteering and public service. We partner with 400 different community organizations to give our students and faculty and staff opportunities to volunteer and learn on the ground. And more than 200 of our courses have community service, volunteering, experiential partnering built into the course. I give one example here. We have a partnership with Maxfield Collaborative School in the Rondo neighborhood of St. Paul, where it's we've really taken it on as the base for our School of Education, where our student teachers work, where our professors go and work with the Maxfield teachers, where we help bring the most effective innovations in teaching to the front lines of the Maxfield School, and it's been a very fruitful partnership. And that's how we envision our mission, is that we are not just in Minnesota and in the Twin Cities and in St. Paul, we are deeply embedded in these communities. And again, it's not just the value of these contributions to our external community, it's the value of the experience of contributing for our students. As I said at the outset, we don't want to be a transactional university where people are just viewing it as we pay you tuition, we get job skills. We do that. We do a really good job of that. We want the experience of St. Thomas to be transformational, and we want it to be transformational regardless of a student's economic background. And we've got a lot of levers that we're pulling to make that a reality, and one key lever has always been the state grant program. So I want to thank you for making this aspiration of ours a reality for thousands and thousands of our students over the generations. Thanks very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, President Fisher. Any comments or questions from members? Oh, I thought maybe Representative Cleburne had something. Really quick, before I go to, did you have a question?
Do we have other presenters?
So we have a student, Representative Cleburne. Very, very good. So I was just going to say that there are 18 colleges in the consortium for the private colleges. This is just a representation of two of the 18. I don't think I have enough time to go through the rest of the 16. I don't think we have enough days on the calendar, but this was a little snapshot for us to see private colleges, two of the 18, and hear a little bit of a high-level overview of the 18. And, of course, there were a couple of colleges outside of that consortium, too. But I would just ask one question, since we've got the great president here from St. Thomas. What does it mean to be a Tommy? And talk about the network of being a Tommy and the network that, you know, because you have a 97% job placement rate and graduate school, so yeah, one or the other.
It's huge. Thanks, Madam Chair, for that question. One of the things we're always trying to impress on our students is focusing on individual achievement is, it's understandable, it's healthy, it's good, but as you go through life, you'll realize that the sustainable path to joy is not individual achievement, it's connection and contribution. So one of the things we try to do from the moment they set foot on campus is help them understand how they connect to a story that's bigger than themselves and how they can contribute that story in their own unique way. That manifests itself in one powerful way through our alumni network with 120,000 living alumni, most of whom are in the state of Minnesota. They are always trying to build their network and fuel the rise of the next generation behind them. And we have, you know, I spend a lot of my time with alumni. They are always coming back to campus, seeing how they can invest in this generation. There's a strong consciousness of this 140-year-old narrative that we're all part of, and how are we going to steward that and hand it off to the next generation with even a stronger forward momentum than it has today. That benefits our students, again, from every economic background, because once they are in the Tommy network, there are people who are strongly invested in their success over the course of their lives. So when you look at the major employers, it's not just hiring through pipelines as pipelines, it's hiring and investment through a keen and intentional and proactive relational interest in this next generation. As we tell our students all the time, it's not just your life and your success and your trajectory depend not just on what you know and what you can do, but are you able to embed yourself in relationships with folks who care about your success? And St. Thomas, I think, has been wonderful about that for many decades.
Thank you, President. I've seen that myself, which is why I asked, what does it mean to be a Tommy? And I bet Chair Wolgamott has more to add.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. And thank you so much to our two presidents for presenting today and giving a snapshot of the incredible value that private colleges bring to Minnesota. And thank you, Mr. Cirkvenik, for coming before the committee and for this information. We know, members, that Minnesota's workforce needs private colleges to be successful. We cannot have the workers that we need to function as an economy without the private colleges. And when we look at the positive outcomes, and I wanted to ask, and this might be on here somewhere, but Madam Chair, Mr. Cirkvenik, if you could tell us, just remind again what the graduation rates are and how those compare to other the other systems.
Mr. Cirkvenik, and maybe it's different across all 18. I know that they just presented that they had a pretty high graduation, but go ahead, Mr. Cirkvenik.
Madam Chair and Co-Chair Wolgamott, our overall four-year graduation rate is 65% in the most recent year, and it's fluctuated between 65 and 68% for many, many years, my whole 15 years in service in this organization. I would also point out that we have a nation-leading graduation rate for Pell students, low-income students across all institutions and across all states have lower graduation rates generally than more wealthy students who come from more wealthy circumstances. Our graduation rate for Pell students is 56%, and it is second in the nation when compared to private colleges at in other 49 states in the District of Columbia.
Chair Wolgamott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that answer, Mr. Cirkvenik. And I think those numbers speak for themselves and show that part of having a balanced approach to higher education in Minnesota, that the private colleges are valuable partners in making sure that our businesses and our economy has the workforce that it needs to succeed. And we know that private colleges have great outcomes when students go there. If you'll indulge me in one last question, Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. President Vischer, thank you so much for that update on St. Thomas and the power of the network. Again, it's just one of the many shining examples of the incredible impact and positive outcomes that our private colleges have in Minnesota. But Madam Chair, as a St. John's graduate, I have one important question I'd like to get on the record, either for President Vischer or Mr. Cirkvinic. Who won the final football game between St. John's and the University of St. Thomas?
You know, on the advice of counsel, I decline to answer that.
Mr. Cirkvinic.
Mr. Cirkvinic.
Madam Chair and Representative Wolgamott, as a proud Johnny, I know who won the last football game.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to get on the record that St. John's did, in fact, win the final matchup of the historic Johnny-Tommy rivalry.
Mr. Chair, I would expect no less from you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifiers.
Wonderful. So we are going to, I think we're going to have a student testify, and then we'll go to Representative Cleavorn. And anybody else have questions specifically for a Tommy that's here? Not the Johnny, but the Tommy. Very good. All right, we will go to the testifier. It looks like Ms. Plouffe is here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Introduce yourself to the committee and continue with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Maddie Plouffe. I am from Cushing, Minnesota, and I am a current senior at the College of Saints Class Glen Duluth. Thank you all for allowing me to speak today. At St. Scholastica, I major in political science and peace and justice studies, and I'm on the pre-law track. I've been a recipient of the Minnesota State Grant during my 3 years at St. Scholastica, and I have served as a student body president for the last 2 years. I'm a proud band and choir member, and I have been an older sister my whole life. And I am certain that without the support of the Minnesota State Grant, that I would not have had the opportunities to do and study what I love, nor have peace of mind about my brother's education. He's in his first year at Minnesota State Technical and Community College in Wadena. He's in their heating, ventilation, air conditioning, and refrigeration program. And while this is the right fit and journey for me, going to a private school in a larger city where my professors truly want each student to succeed in whatever way success looks like for them, while challenging them to expand their minds and opinions, has been essential my education and career development. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I have known my whole life that a four-year institution was the path for me and what I wanted to pursue for exposure to ideas and opportunities. In high school, I worked hard and earned good grades, participated in many extracurriculars, and created great connections with my teachers and community leaders. On paper, I was well prepared for college, except for one aspect, affording it. As a child of a public school teacher and retired police officer, my family has not struggled to meet our basic needs, but college does not fit into that category. I have been fortunate that St. Scholastica does offer merit scholarships that have financed many of my college expenses, granting me the possibility of attending a higher education and institution. But I am one of the lucky ones because I meet all the financial and scholastic requirements. St. Scholastica was truly the best option for me financially, academically, and community-wise, because I have not only done well at St. Scholastica, but I've met my best friends, grown as a person and leader, and truly enjoyed my academics, while preparing me to continue my studies at the University of St. Thomas Law School this fall. St. Scholastica has been the right place for me, as it is for my peers. 28% of St. Scholastica students are Minnesota State Grant recipients and depend on this aid to finance their education. Due to the shortfall in funds this summer, this year, I received a total of $800 from the Minnesota State Grant Program, but I expected, based on previous years, to receive about $2,000. Finding this out in late summer, while I was already working a job that does not allow me to take on additional hours alongside having an unpaid internship, led me to take on a second job during the school year. Some students will only thrive in a small class and school environment, such as myself at St. Scholastica, which is why continuing and expanding the Minnesota State Grant Program is imperative, because a deficit for the program is a deficit for Minnesota students and a deficit for quality of life for all Minnesota. That is my aspiration, and I hope it is yours too, as you hold great power in dictating the future of higher education in Minnesota. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Now we'll go to Representative Cleavorn. You had a question or comment. So, Madam Chair, this question, the first question I have is for you. When we've had other nonprofits before us, you've provided us with extensive 990s. In this particular case today, you did not. Is there a reason for that?
Thank you, Representative Claiborne. So I had done that when we had a specific line item in our spreadsheet, and there are 18 of them. So I would have to give you 18 990s and audited financials as opposed to having an individual. But you certainly can, now that you know how to, you can certainly.
Oh, I've known how to for a long time.
There you go, Representative Claiborne.
That goes into my next part of this. And I want to be really careful because I don't want to call any particular institution out by name. I think that would be, I don't actually like that practice of calling out institutions by name. So I went through a lot of the 990s for the institutions, and there's certainly not a space for a broad brush. You have some that are struggling, and you have some that are doing very well. So in looking at our state grant crisis that we have before us, as I look at these numbers, I think, how do we get the most money to the students who need them most? So you have some institutions that have lost $1 million in the last 990. That's what they're showing. You have others that have had net income, net revenue minus expenses of over $65 million, right? So when we're looking at how to allocate precious resources, we need to think about how do we get the dollars where they are most needed. So I think it's time for us, Madam Chair, to think about the state grant program as a whole, right? So when we think about, I think every student benefits by small class sizes. Our state colleges and universities don't have the luxury of small class sizes because we limit what they have to spend. I think that every student benefits by having tenured faculty. Our state institutions, not all of them have that opportunity because of the limited funding that we provide at the legislature. So I just want to kind of go through this a little bit. In looking at the OHE report on state grants and who gets how much money where. So the average grant for the Minnesota State Colleges is $1,415 based on the last 2024 report. The Minnesota State University average grant is $3,226. Now, when we get to our four-year public institutions, these grants vary from $4,300 for Crookston to $6,400 for Twin Cities. Now, there's kind of a little bit of a mix for me when I go to the private institutions, because the private institutions also include White Earth, where the average grant is $798. To, I think, the most expensive for the private, again, I won't name that private institution, was $6,800. So you can see there is a large discrepancy in the state grant program. So as we're looking at how do we allocate these dollars and where do they go, I think we also need to look at the institutions that have the disposable money, right, to and who have these larger net revenues. Right? But I also think we really need to find out what the average real cost of attendance is, not necessarily the advertised price, but what is the real price for the private institutions. I agree wholeheartedly with Chair Wokamot that we need to have a robust private system. As one of our public, I think it was an OHE member, said to me, we can't absorb all of those students in the public system. But I think we're at an inflection point where we're seeing that we're dividing the pie so many ways that we're not keeping a strong public institution that we just keep escalating tuition, which is not a sustainable solution for our students, either in the public or private system. So I think this is an important time for us to have these conversations. And I've asked for the information with the private colleges previously.
please let us know which institutions need help. We want to make sure that we have students who are enrolling there, we're not in an Argosy situation all over again with the collapse of a college. So I want to be a good partner to the privates, but my obligation and my duty is to the public institutions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. I would just say that the state grant program is designed to be portable. So it's about the student being able to go to the school of their choice. I'm going to go to Representative Robbins, and then we'll come back to the testifiers if they have any comments. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifiers and to the student online. So I just wanted to respond to that a little bit, and I thank you, Madam Chair, for pointing out that our obligation is to the students, not any particular set of institutions. And the beauty of the state grant is that students are making the choice where they go. It is up to the students. And because the state grant for privates is limited to it's capped at the same level as the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, there is no favoritism towards the privates, even if their sort of front rate tuition is higher. The cap exists for that reason, so that everyone's on par. And so I think we have to be very careful about saying we're supporting different institutions at different levels. We are not, and the students make the decisions where they go that fits their needs, their geographic needs, their interest in a program, whatever it is, why they make these decisions. And that's why we have one of the most robust public and private higher ed systems in the country. Like, what we have here is incredible. You don't see this many successful privates in a state of our size, I don't think anywhere else in the country. And this robust academic environment has led to incredible research, incredible economic growth, attracted so much talent to our state. So I think when we're thinking about this question, improving and supporting the state grant to ensure the robust environment for higher ed that we have here, I think should be a strong priority for all of us to help drive economic growth in our state. And there was one other point I was making notes. Let me just see if I can go back to it. Just the point about some of the states have higher or private schools have higher net income or not. I would just, in response to that, say we are giving a lot of money to public institutions, and the Mayo Foundation, and their endowments dwarf anything, I'm sure, in any of the privates. So I think that's what we need to focus on, is having a healthy higher ed environment that supports where students want to go. And the state grant program, because it's capped, it's fair between students who choose non-public and students who choose public, and that's been such a secret sauce strength in Minnesota, and I want to see that preserved. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. Yep, Representative Cleavorn, and let me just, before we go here, is there anybody else that wants to have a comment or a question? Okay, so back to Representative Cleavorn.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that it was really clear what I said. I talked about the disparities in the amount that students receive based on where they go. I talked about average award to students who go to state colleges, students who go to the state universities. It is incredible to me that we as public legislators charged with stewardship of our public institutions are not understanding or not wanting to see that we do have an obligation to ensure that those public institutions stay strong. And what I'm saying is that we are now dividing the pie in so many ways that no matter where you go, private college students have higher debt. Public school students have higher debt. We have to figure out a way to make this more equitable. If it is truly portable per student, then it needs to be equitable per student. And I'm sorry, but we have private institutions that are not the equivalent of the University R1 institution, who receive, anytime the University of Minnesota, who we say we're not going to fund, has to raise their tuition, nothing changed at the private college, but their students now get more money in the state formula. That doesn't seem right to me. It doesn't hit my fairness gene for the students who are going to the Minnesota State Colleges who aren't having their tuition tied to the University of Minnesota, or the ones who are attending the state universities aren't tied to the University of Minnesota. So it is an inequitable system that needs to be repaired. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. You know, we're open to all the thoughts, and I appreciate them all. I really do. Thank you for bringing that forward. We'll, Chair Wolgamott and I will take that, and you know, this is where all that work happens, because we have hard choices. We don't have targets. After targets, we may have harder choices. And you know what was interesting, Representative Cleavorn, is how many of us on this committee are chairs ourselves. We're pretty chair heavy on this committee, as you look around the table. We are, aren't we? So, yeah, there's a lot of weight on all of us as chairs. And I know you feel as well, because you've got a big area as well. I can go down the row. We all have big areas of responsibility. And Chair Wolgamott and I take your thoughts and your concerns and your ideas incredibly seriously. I'm listening. We'll take a look at all of those things, because we have to make some hard choices going forward. I wish we just had a simple solution, but unfortunately, I don't think we're at that place where we have a simple solution. So thank you. Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. I'm going to turn it back over to Mr. Cirkvenic for closing comments, or if you want to respond to any of the conversation we've had around the table. And before I do that, any other members that wanted to ask a question or have a comment? Okay, seeing none, back to Representative Cirkvenic. Mr. Cirkvenic.
Madam Chair, I think we're over our time already, so I just want to say thank you for the time to testify. And again, thank you to every member who invests in students through the Minnesota State Grant Program. It's a profoundly transformational investment for those students. Thank you.
Mr. Cirkvenic and presidents, I don't know if we still have the president on Zoom, but thank you, and thank you for what you do, and thank you for your universities and taking the time to share that with us today. And we may be over time, but it is worth it, because the members need to think about things, hear about things, and discuss things. So thank you. With that, we will move forward. We have, we'll bring Ohi up. And I'm going to stay in the chair spot here, but we're going to have first House File 2312 as Ohi starts to come up. And I will put move that House File 2312 come before us, and we're going to be laying this bill over, members. So Ohi will present their policy bill first. All right, so House File 2312 is before us, members, and we have the commissioner of OHI in front of us, and his team is arriving here. That's good. To you, Commissioner Olson.
Madam Chair, members, Nikki's going to actually take the policy bill, so I'll hand it over to her, but I'm wondering if we can turn this camera off. I'm not liking this view of whatever's going on. Appreciate it, whoever was able to do that.
Thank you.
Oh, it's always a good day when Commissioner Olson is here. Ms. Oliver, we will turn it over to you to present what is in your policy bill for OHI.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Nikki Oliver. I'm the Director of Government Relations and Community Engagement for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. And I guess they chose me so I can get through this very quickly so you guys can hear from the commissioner. So section one of this bill deals with the campus sexual misconduct policy, and it's adding a campus sexual misconduct grievance resolution process to make things simpler and stable for students on campus. Section 2 is adding a definition to terms that we are using in that statute and also adding the private colleges. We added policies that institutions must abide by for their pregnant and parenting students last session, I believe, or the session before, and that only incorporated the public, so we wanted to include the privates. Section 3 consolidates competitive grant and student loan repayment programs to hopefully streamline them. This consolidation would standardize data collection and align report deadlines to improve efficiency for agency staff and hopefully make it easier for you all and the public in accessing program information. It also will, there are some programs that we don't have mandated reports for. This will also require us to collect some of this information for some of those reports as well. Section 4 and 5, we're just adding the word accredited to the dual training grants where it says industry recognized credentials, degrees, and certificates, just making sure that it's noted that those should be accredited programs. Section 6, for our planning information statute, it's removing some information that we gather and house on OHE's website. It's actually information that all the institutions post on their website, and we would prefer these students go to their individual schools to get that information, and they would get it more quickly if anything changes if they go that route rather than waiting on OHE to collect all that information from an institution and then post it on our website. I know your nonpartisan staff is not fond of us doing that because I think they're one of the few people that use our website currently. Section 7 seeks to define in law what is current practice for the spinal cord traumatic brain injury research grant. It just mentions eligible institutions. We just want to define and build that out specifically in law. We currently, obviously, with that program, fund a range of programs, both private, public, from Mayo to the University of Minnesota and some other, veterans facilities and stuff that do spinal cord traumatic brain injury research. The next part, I'm almost done, actually. So I'm like, oh, that's short. The next sections I think I'll talk about are the report consolidation or repeal. So we're repealing three reports that have either the information can be found elsewhere or the reports have not changed in what is being sent to us, meaning they are... Excuse me. Yeah, so like the study of, sorry, I'll mention the specific report, sorry. Study abroad health and safety report. We've been collecting this data for over a decade now, and we haven't seen any significant changes in that. So it just seems like a necessary report at the time for staff capacity and time. And then transfer student report and the dual credit and exam-based credit acceptance. And some of that information is already collected elsewhere and put in like our My Higher Ed. So kind of some of these reports are redundant as well. And then there are a few repeals for obsolete rules or rules that contradict statute. And I can answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you, Ms. Oliver. We'll start with Representative Scott and then we'll go to Representative Cleburne. Did you have a question? Okay, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Oliver, I'm just curious on line 3.5 and 3.6. You've landed on preponderance of evidence. I'm just curious as to what went into deciding that level versus clear and convincing or anything else.
Ms. Oliver, and I would add to that, too, you are expanding this to all institutions, correct? So all of the privates would have to adhere to this as well. So I'll just add that question to her question. Ms. Oliver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, we're adding all the privates. And I'd like to hand it over to a colleague of mine, Missy she can answer your question better. I also want to note that in this policy bill, we have been working with Representative Hansen on a kind of clone bill that's more comprehensive, and in our hopes that you all would also hear that. Those changes, we would like to be a part of that section as well, because they incorporate some more recent feedback we got from institutions and some additional changes. But I will allow Missy to answer the question.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Melissa Watchke. I'm the Title IX Training Administrator with the Sexual Violence Prevention and Response Program at Office of Higher Education. To your question, Representative, the preponderance of evidence is pretty much the standard of practice in sexual misconduct grievance processes. Federally, it is noted in Title IX, the 2020 regulations, that standard of evidence is preponderance of evidence unless other similar conduct procedures require something else. In the state of Minnesota, in my analysis of this, there's one institution in the state of Minnesota that has something other than preponderance of the evidence, and they have clear and convincing. And I'm going to leave it at that, unless you'd like to know who it is.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, back to Ms. Oliver. What was the bill number, the other bill number that you're working on?
Ms. Oliver.
If you have one, you can get back to me.
Or Representative Hansen, if you happen to have it.
Thank you, Chair. I was just pulling out my paperwork to get you the bill number, and I'm looking for it, and I can have that. I'll send it to you in just a second as soon as I pull it up.
Sounds good.
Thanks,
thank you.
Representative Scott and Chair.
So, Representative Scott, I believe it's 2008.
Yep. 2008.
You're welcome. We have quick.
That was the year I was elected.
Wow.
Representative Scott. So, back to the testifier on Title IX. So I was skimming through Title IX yesterday. I didn't see the evidence standard on there. So if you could shoot me an email, or if you happen to know offhand the citation of where we could find that. Just in speaking with someone that works for a different college here in the state of Minnesota, their policy doesn't define any level of evidence as being the standard. I just want to make sure if we're going to make everyone, go along with this and require this level of evidence, I just want to make sure that that it's the right thing to do. And I know you mentioned there's just one other college in the state of Minnesota that has a different standard. But in my conversations, and I haven't talked to a lot of folks from colleges, it just doesn't even give a standard. So I just want to make sure we're doing right by the students. And as you know, preponderance is just more likely that it happened than it didn't. And so many of these situations is he said, she said, right? And getting to the bottom of that. So I appreciate the line of questioning. If you could, I don't know if you have the citation with you or if you want to send it to me, that'd be great. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Ms. Watchke, do you have an answer?
Chair Rarick and Representative Scott, I do not have that provision, but I can send it to you.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Completely different question about
go
the
right
bill.
Ahead,
just shifting
Liebling.
Gears entirely, if that's okay. So I have a question on the section about the grants for spinal cord research. And so I'm on the line 9.1 and 9.2 where you're adding institutions that are eligible to apply. First of all, Madam Chair, I don't know if we kind of really went through those particular grants. Did we go through that in one of our overviews? We did. Okay.
Representative Liebling, we did. When we had OHE here early on as they were kind of walking through, because this is one of the pass-throughs through OHE, and because it doesn't go to, for certain, it's more of an RFP process, and so they just talked about it briefly. But they did say something to the effect of it's not really within their wheelhouse to do this kind of grant. And this goes back to what you and I have talked about this whole time through, is that we really need to look at the core mission of OHE, and some of these things probably belong in health or
elsewhere, but maybe not here.
Right. So thank you for that, Madam Chair. So I guess so. I just want to put my orientation toward this out front, which is that it's long been kind of the idea that the state of Minnesota really doesn't do basic research because we provide services. Mm-hmm. And until very, very recently, it seems, the National Institutes of Health was the big funder of research. Now, I know that we're in this situation where that money is largely being, a lot of it may be pulled back, some has been pulled back. So, you know, I'm aware of that, and that does create a real conundrum for us. But it's been a problematic for the state, and I know we've done it in a few instances like this, like the one before us, and they haven't really come through health. And when they have, in fact, I remember a hearing where there was a lot of pushback, frankly, from the disability community. Because as much as everyone wants there to be research and cures and all of that, we're all competing for the same pot of money. And basic research is a very expensive thing to do. And it also, you know, there is always this question of, are we the best place to do it from? Exactly what the chair just talked about. Because when you're NIH, National Institutes of Health, and you're looking with a nationwide perspective, you can say, well, let's see, maybe we should have these three centers that are well equipped to do this research doing it, and they can make sure that it's not, that what competition there is between, that they're not using their money in ways that are inefficient, that it's going out, that it's doing the most good. And I've often struggled with the fact that we in Minnesota don't really have that ability. We don't have the structure in place as a state to make these decisions, which researcher should get it, what kind of research is really, you know, driving towards some discovery, all of that stuff. So I'm a little concerned, especially as we're looking at possibly needing to pull back a lot of our own funding at this in general. But then what I'm seeing in this bill is making more institutions eligible for a grant. And that really gives me a little bit of pause. I'd really like to hear more about that because, you know, we're talking here about, I think we're talking about a lot of basic research, I think. And I don't know, can post-secondary institutions, nonprofit organizations, and for-profit organizations, I'd like to understand, like, who is going to be eligible for this and how is this going to fit into our struggle to try to make sure that we're using our money in the best possible way and getting, you know, if we're going to do this at all, which I, as I say, I feel conflicted about, how are we going to make sure our dollars are going to the absolute best use within this program? Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Yes, that is something that we have struggled in this whole, I'd say, since we've all come back together. And it's a $6 million biennial appropriation for this specific thing. It is something that I've spoken with the commissioner about, that this is, it's difficult for them. And I think this is probably them telling us this is difficult for them. And maybe it's best suited in a different committee, the health committee, most likely. I see we've got a couple people up to try to answer the question. I know this isn't easy, so we'll, Ms. Oliver, do you want to start? And then we'll go to Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Liebling. This program has been around actually for quite a while now. Almost a decade.
Yeah, 2015.
Yeah, 2015. Yeah, everything since I started, mm-hmm. I guess. Yes, and we actually already fund these types of institutions, so it's just putting in practice and making clearer. And this program actually has an advisory council of experts that actually review the and researchers in the field of spinal cord and traumatic brain injury research that review these applications. And a lot of discussions about how NIH works and all of that actually went into the development of the RFP originally, and we lean heavily on the advisory council for their expertise in choosing and who we award for these. And I'll if you allow me to pass it over to Megan, who actually runs the program now.
Ms. Fitzgibbon, please introduce yourself again to us and
continue. Megan Fitzgibbon, the manager of grants and workforce initiatives at the office. And Ms. Oliver's correct. This amendment is purely technical. It's in order to just be clear that that is who are eligible. The grant has always awarded to those institutions. Because it's in our statutes, in the OHE statutes, the definition of eligible institutions actually exists and is only post-secondary institutions. And so we wanted to make sure that it was clear that in addition to post-secondary institutions, other organizations like the Center for Veterans Research or Hennepin Healthcare's Research Foundation can also apply for this like they have since the beginning of this program. So this isn't expanding who is eligible. It is just clarifying in law who is eligible. Again, as Ms. Oliver said, this program has been around since 2014, I believe. We do have an annual report that's required, which is on our website, and I know it's been furnished to the committee that we fund research. It funds research in spinal cord injury and traumatic brain injury every year. We've got different tiers. There's early research all the way through to clinical research that's happening in the state. And seeing real results, and that's demonstrated in the report as well as other that links to other research that's happening in the state as well. We've heard from the advisory council that often what's funded through this program is the starting point and is the way the avenue for clinical research to get expanded and additional support through other avenues, NIH and other private foundations as well.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the time. I was here then, and I kind of remember it, so it doesn't seem that long ago to me, I have to say. And 10 years, we've been a state for a whole lot longer than that. Doesn't mean we should continue doing something if we've done it for 10 years. But the fact that it's going to some organizations that are not higher education kind of makes the point, mm-hmm. I think, that the chair was making, mm-hmm. that this may not be the right way to do this. So I'll just leave it at that. But thank you so much for the discussion, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Yeah, we are grappling in all of this and trying to really focus what is the mission of this committee, what is the mission for OHE, and really, we've had this conversation all day just in different ways. And so I think we are all wanting the best for the students. I think that's at the core. Making sure that what we're doing here is taking care of the students first. And this is a little different. This was, it's been called a gift from the legislature as OHE administrates it. So we definitely need to have these conversations, and we'll continue those as we move forward in the budget discussions as well, too. So thank you for bringing that up. Any other member conversation right now? Any other member questions? Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, and mine is doesn't have to be answered at this moment because we're laying this over for possible inclusion, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so when I see, last year when I was chair, I was going to allow quite a few reports to just be canceled, thinking, okay, I'm being told that they're not important and we can maybe save some costs by cutting these reports. And then I discovered that a lot of research is done based on these reports. So just as an offline conversation at some point, I'd like to know why these reports. I mean, the spinal program is still being funded, right? So why wouldn't we want to know who receives those funds? And if the information's available someplace else, I'm okay with that, right? I just want to make sure that we don't lose important data as we're later trying to evaluate whether the program is good or not good. That's it. So it's not a complaint or a critique. It's just a conversation.
Thank you, Representative Cleburne. Ms. Oliver, anyone else want to?
Yeah, Madam Chair, just one clarification. So there's two things happening. There's the consolidation of reporting. We're not, we're going to eliminate the individual reports in statute, but create a new report system with the same, they're still required to provide the same information. You'll still get the same data for the program. And then there's three reports we're repealing. And I can provide you specifics on why they're being removed. Those specific reports are being removed. And I think Missy has a clarification she wants to make about a statement earlier, I think, to Rep. Scott's question.
Go ahead.
Chair Rarick, Representative Scott, I did find the provision in Title IX. It is 145B, 1-7, if you can get that. There's been a lot going on with Title IX, if anyone knows, so it's kind of a hard thing to stay on top of. The standard of evidence in Title IX 2020 regulations, an institution needs to publish the standard of evidence, and they can choose between preponderance of the evidence or clear and convincing, as long as, again, that is the same standard of evidence between employees and students on complaints of sexual harassment, knowing that the majority of Minnesota schools do use preponderance of the evidence. So,
Representative Scott.
Thank you for that. And I guess I'm wondering why we would want to take away an institution's ability to decide that for themselves.
Ms. Watchke.
I think it is more, Chair Rarick and Representative Scott, I think it's more the standard of practice that Minnesota schools are using, and across the nation most schools are using preponderance of evidence, but definitely something to consider.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. I'm just wondering what the value is in making this universal. It seems to be working fine the way it is, but thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that information. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Scott. That could be something that we could continue to talk about. I think we still have the privates, and they're always in the room. If they have anything that they want to add, the private colleges, since they're kind of being lumped in now. And I think Representative Robbins, you had a question. Okay. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for presenting this bill. I just wondered, on line 7.22 to 7.27, you're striking the provisions where OHE gathers information about how dual credits are accepted, which I think is important to a lot of families as they're planning. So could you just talk about why you're striking that? Thank you.
Ms. Oliver.
Madam Chair, Representative Robbins, excuse me. As previously stated, this is information that all the individual colleges collect and post, and we would rather the students go to their individual college to get that information, especially as it gets updated regularly, versus waiting for our office to collect it from every institution and then post it just on the central location. So, but also, if we can have someone else answer in more detail if you like, but.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and maybe that is the most practical, but I just think when students go to the OHE website and they're looking at all the financials and all the different sort of writ large things, if there was a place where they could quickly see where the dual credits work, it just, rather than having to go to everybody's website and figure it out, it just seems like it was a nice to have. Maybe it's too hard to do, so I get that, but it seems like it was something people appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins.
Yeah.
Okay, any other member comments or questions? Did the private colleges want to come up and make any comments or anything about the bill as you're affected by some of the changes? Okay, seeing none. Any other members of the public would like to test? Oh, Representative Robbins.
Sorry, I did have one more question I forgot. To Chair Liebling's questioning about this final grant research, I appreciate your thinking on that, and I share a lot of your concerns. So I just wondered, why could you just send us a list of where that grant research already gets done? Because it seems like you're adding that now it's available for post-secondary, nonprofit, and for-profit. So I just wonder who else is going to be eligible, and is it the same pot of money that will now be eligible to more people? It doesn't still appear like it's a competitive grant process, which is always a concern of mine. So if you could just send us more detail on that, thank you.
Ms. Oliver.
Yep. Madam Chair, we can send that information. It is a competitive grant, and again, we're just putting in practice, so we're not adding institutions again, because in our statutes we have a definition for eligible institutions, and it's solely post-secondary institutions, but for this program's purpose, it wasn't supposed to just be post-secondary institutions, which is how it's been operating. So we just wanted it to be clear. It's kind of cleaning up the statute, making things clear. Granted, I know this is a regular session and not an un-session, but we figured might as well now. So, yeah.
Thank you, Ms. Oliver. I'm going to just check to make sure we don't have any members of the public that wanted to offer testimony. Okay, seeing none. Okay, great. Do you have any closing remarks about this bill?
No, but I have opening remarks about your next bill.
All right. Any other final member comments or questions? Okay, seeing none, the bill is laid over. All right. All right, so we are going to, I'm going to bring up House File, House File 2431. This is Chair Wolgamont's bill. Would you like to stay where you are? Do you want to go and join them? It is the dealer's choice.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to bring forward House File 2431. I'm more than fine staying where I'm at, and we'll leave it to our highly qualified team from OHE to proceed with the bill.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamont. All right, so the bill is before us. To the bill.
And yes. Madam Chair, I'd move that it be laid over.
Yes, we'll be laying it over. Mm-hmm. So the bill is before us. Commissioner, to the bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Wolgamont, as well, and thank you, members. Before I jump in here, I want to just hand it over to Nikki for some clarifying comments on some amendment pieces, and then we'll jump in.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee, and also knowing that we are here last minute because we're also presenting in the Senate, and we have our lovely staff here. We thank you all for allowing us to do these bills today so they didn't have to come back from wherever they were at to come and answer questions and present. And with that, this bill in front of you is not in the final form it should be in, and there is an author's amendment, but due to time and it was not introduced, and understanding you all would lay it over. So I know you all probably saw a tuition freeze for Men's State in there. That is not included. These are some kind of copy-paste edit errors that happened during drafting that we will get fixed in an author's amendment, and same with some numbers. And one of the proposals in the Gov's recommendation that you probably won't see the actual change in the bill, it's a part of the amendment that will come later that the commissioner will talk about. So I just wanted to make that preface before we begin.
Thank you, Ms. Oliver. And I believe we are printing the slide deck as we speak, but we'll just go ahead with the presentation because we've got a little bit less than 30 minutes. Commissioner Olson.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Noted. I will step on the gas here. Again, appreciate that.
Commissioner Olson, you have time. You've got plenty of time.
All right. Appreciate it. Well, once again, Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to briefly walk through the governor's budget bill here today. As you remember from our previous testimony in front of the committee, we've discussed several of these provisions within the governor's bill already. When we were doing overviews, and so glad to be here for the actual bill introduction. Really, there are just a couple of small general fund requests that the governor is making, as well as a handful of budget neutral items as well, no cost proposals aimed to clarify some statutes and provide some efficiencies in program administration. So I'll jump into the state grant. We had displayed this slide the last time we were here walking through the deep dive of the state grant. But here the governor's proposing what, again, we believe to be the most effective way to bring projected spending back within available appropriated resources and eliminate the need to ration state grant awards. And so as you can see on the slide, the governor's proposing an adjustment to several of the formula parameters, in addition to recommending an investment of $7.5 million each fiscal year, or $15 million over the biennium. And the proposal also recommends changes to the agency's authority to reduce grant awards in the event of a projected program deficit, which is certainly timely given conversation we had prior, and of course following Private College Counsel's testimony this afternoon as well. So essentially, these parameter changes, one, will allow the agency to set a minimum parental contribution or student contribution of zero when calculating the state grant awards, unless, of course, we have projected resources that are going to exceed spending. And this change is in line with federal guidance for awarding aid. We've talked a lot about the changes in FAFSA, particularly the transition from the AGI to the SAI, what is now the Student Aid Index. Because state statute didn't prohibit the use of negative values for the SAI, The result is that students with negative SAIs received essentially a significant boost to their state grant award. And I believe Ms. Schneider, last time we were here, shared an example. It was either her or Ms. Flores, you know, of a student who previously would have had a zero EFC or expected family contribution, would have received a $500 state grant award. That same student now, under the SAI formula, who would have been awarded or assigned a negative 1,500 SAI, correspondingly now would have received a $2,000 state grant. So that has put a tremendous amount of pressure on the state grant program. And so we're looking to make that correction in state statute to set that at zero. And then the proposal also adjusts state grant parameters, including decreasing the living and miscellaneous expense, the LME allowance to 110% of the federal poverty guideline. Also proposes to increase the assigned student responsibility to 51% beginning in fiscal 27. The proposal also increases the assigned family responsibility, the AFR side of the formula, to 100% of the federal need analysis for all families with a positive parent contribution or student contribution beginning in fiscal year 2026. So that is the differentials between dependent, independent, and independents with dependents. It also reverts the deadline for state grant receipt to the 30th day of the term for which a student applies for aid. And then again, I'd mentioned, it modifies the language that governs how the agency rations awards for the program when there's a program spending deficit projected. So, Madam Chair, members, that is the state grant portion of the governor's recommendation. The next one here, I invited up Mr. Andrew Wold to talk through licensing and registration. Before he does, I think I'll just quickly address the bottom bullet on the slide there, and that is the agency operating adjustment. So the governor's recommending additional funding for the Office of Higher Education's agency operations in the amount of $162,000 in fiscal 26 and $328,000 in each subsequent year for the general fund to help address operating cost increases at the Office of Higher Education. These, of course, help cover expected growth in employee compensation and insurance, rents, IT services, as well as other operating costs. And Madam Chair, with that, I'd like to hand it over to Mr. Wold to talk specifically through the changes for licensing and registration.
Thank you, Commissioner Olson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record to continue with your testimony.
Madam Chair, my name is Andrew Wold. I'm General Counsel and Director of Compliance here at the Office of Higher Education, and I'm happy to discuss the proposals that we have for our licensing and registration unit. I know that we have spoken, I've spoken with a few representatives here about this program in the past and some of the efficiencies that we hope to create, some of the ways that we change the budget in order to provide more capacity to do the important work that we do in this unit. The Institutional Registration and Licensing Unit licenses and registers over 400 institutions, approves thousands of programs every year, from horseshoeing to doctorate-level engineering programs. We investigate student complaints, manage the state authorization reciprocity agreement, and set Minnesota standards for higher education. We do this with a staff of three people. The lack of capacity in this work unit has been problematic for several years, and the proposed fee changes and modifications to the relevant acts will allow OHE to hire and retain a full-time permanent academic program reviewer, and the efficiencies created within the acts will allow our small but mighty institutional registration and licensing team to do this work in order to better protect students, meet institutions' needs, and market demands for higher education programs and the workforce in general. So I'm happy to walk through what has been a structural deficit since about 2017 and the proposals that we have here, you know, section by section, if you like, or I can open it up for just questions around some of the changes that we're making.
Mr. Wold, why don't you go ahead and do a quick walkthrough? And sure. I'm looking for member questions and comments. So I've got an eagle eye out here. So go ahead, Mr. Wold.
Thank you. So in Section 16, this amends the fees for participation in the State Authorization Reciprocity Agreement. Section 17 amends and right-sizes a lot of the fees for registered institutions, moving those from programmatic level to an enrollment in institutions. So larger institutions are going to pay more for participation or for registration. It also simplifies the fee structure so that new programs won't have a fee. Everything will be included in a renewal fee, which is being raised. But going into this, institutions will know upfront what they're going to have to pay for everything, upfront pricing. And section, where am I, 18, adds a policy section for the licensed schools, the Private Career School Act, which exists for the Minnesota Private and Out-of-State Public Post-Secondary Education Act. There is already that policy section. We were informed by a court that it was lacking here and agreed, and so we're adding that to this. Section 19 and 20, this is where we're creating some of the efficiencies within the Act for the Private Career School Act. We are moving many exemptions to be removed from the definitions, removed from the scope of the Private Career School Act in total. And some of these just make sense. For instance, in Section 19, a person does not extend to a government body, a public school, or a non-public school. Those previously were exempt institutions, meaning that we should actually treat them as private career schools and request an exemption application. That process never existed for, you know, public and private schools, and so just removing them from the definitions of person under the Private Career School Act just makes sense. Similarly, the private career school definition in Section 20, this is where we're doing the bulk of the change from exempt programs to removing them from the definitions from applicability to the Act. And a lot of these were made just to create more efficiencies within our scope and really getting down to what we should be doing as a regulatory body. There are some in here that there are many here that we're just removing from the definitions because it doesn't make sense. For the, for instance, let me find what subdivision it is. Schools with no physical presence; those would be governed under the state authorization reciprocity agreement. There's no need for us to have an exemption there. Continuing education requirements, business-to-business exemption. You know, when we're thinking of a business-to-business exemption and we're talking about a consumer protection aspect here, who is the consumer we're protecting when it should be a savvy business person there with the school, negotiating with the school for participation? So anyhow, I'll move on. If you have any other questions about that, I'm happy to provide. We add some definitions for vocational, trade union, eligible training provider list in sections 21 through 24. We are removing academy or institute as name only needs for licensed schools. And we are adding, I consulted with Deed on this, we're adding participation on the eligible training provider list so that we can still review those. And they can be posted on the list that Deed manages. We're in section 27, just making a change to a reasonable period of time to more specific 60 days, again, so that licensed institutions can have proper notice of the amount of time. Section 28. There we are making that change as well, removing academy and institute and adding participation in state financial aid or being listed on the eligible training provider list as reasons for licensure. Section 29, this is where we amend the fees for licensure, and section 30 is for renewal. Section 31, we're increasing the solicitor permit fee. Section 32, multiple location fee, also being increased. And then section 33 is where we delete all of those exemptions that we moved outside of the scope of the Private Career School Act. by adding them to the definition section. Additionally, we are, you can see many of these are stricken, but there are some sections that have changes. What was paragraph 9 on line 48.6, this is for avocational programs, primarily for personal development, recreation, remedial education, generally intended for vocational or career, not generally intended for vocational or career advancement. We are adding to that, as in removing from the need for licensure, exercise or fitness teacher programs, modeling and acting, which was in a, the modeling and acting was in a separate exemption, but is avocational for the purposes of this. Something like an exercise or fitness teacher program, the majority of people who do those yoga teacher training programs are doing it for their own personal benefit, not because they're going to go become a full-time yoga teacher. And there are a lot of those schools, and the consumer protection benefit just doesn't seem to make sense when we're looking for efficiencies to create with our small staff to improve capacity. Section 34, again, just gives a specific timeline for application. So I will leave it there. And if there are any specific questions, I'm happy to address.
Thank you. Do you have any other additional presentation, or is you do? All right, Commissioner Olson, back to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to Mr. Wolf for reminding me that we also do oversee horseshoeing programs. I forgot about that, but I usually let folks know that, you know, within that division, you know, oversee everything from small schools of barbering and massage schools and all the way up to our private nonprofits, like we heard from this afternoon. So appreciate that. Madam Chair, members, just a couple of other additional no-cost budget items here wanted to make the committee aware of within the bill. The next is a change to the Tribal College Supplemental Grant Assistance Program. Again, one we had previewed in a previous agency overview. This, the intent of this proposal is to transition the operations and maintenance funding of $1 million annually per tribal college, transitioning it from a legislatively named grant to incorporate it into the existing Tribal College Supplemental Assistance Grant Program. Essentially into a formula grant program, and so it establishes a floor of $1 million per tribal college and a ceiling of $1,050,000. And so that may sound a little confusing. The existing program is only for non-beneficiary students enrolled within tribal colleges, and each tribal college is eligible for $50,000. So it essentially sets a floor of $1 million, fulfilling the legislative intent to provide them with that O&M funding, and then still eligible, of course, for up to $50,000 for non-beneficiary students. So taking two and incorporating them into to one program. Madam Chair, the governor is also recommending some change to the Emergency Assistance Grant Program, EAPS. And this essentially modifies appropriation language to provide the EAPS funds directly to the University of Minnesota, as well as directly to Minnesota State College and University system. The office would still retain the grant program on behalf of private colleges and tribal colleges as well, but creates a little bit of efficiency there for the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State to be able to award those directly through their existing programs. And then, Madam Chair, also a change to North Star Promise, some statutory changes, essentially they're eliminating within the language instances where North Star Promise was paying for out-of-state tuition, and that is not the intent of the legislature, the intent of the program, and so clarifying statute there, as well as eliminating instances where North Star Promise funds were paying for courses that are ineligible, essentially. A student may have completed all necessary courses to be awarded a baccalaureate degree, and may be still taking courses, but essentially, according to the program, they have completed a baccalaureate degree and so would no longer be eligible for North Star Promise. And so making that that clear within statute language and program language. And then finally, Madam Chair, members, two changes, again, no cost changes to the Minnesota Self-Loan Program. As a reminder, this program does not impact state general fund dollars at all. It's completely, no pun intended, self-funded. But the governor here is recommending an increase in the amount reserved for student loan bonds. This program is, however, funded by the sale of bonds. And so increasing the cap from 10 million, or the access from 10 million to 25 million per year in the agency's tax exempt allocation in the small issue pool, the one we access to fund bonds. And then as well as represents no change again, sorry, to the general fund budget. And then technical changes as well to clarify either contradictory or duplicative language within the statute. So making making clear some of the self-loan statutes. And Madam Chair, members, that really is the whole of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Olson. So before I go to member questions, I want to see if there's anyone, any members of the public that want to testify about this bill. Okay, not seeing any. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Apologies, I was trying to find it, and I know you said the bill's not in the final form, but I either couldn't find it or it's not in the bill, and either is possible. So I want to ask about something back from the governor's budget recommendations, reverting the deadline for state grant receipt to the 30th day of the term. Can you, I'm not exactly sure what that means. Can you just explain what that is and what the purpose is?
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Coulter. We do have our Director of Research, Carrie Schneider, here. I'd like to ask her to come up to walk through that a little bit because there are some technical components to the reasoning for that change.
Welcome to the committee. Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Coulter. I'm just going to take a minute to find it in my notes because I know I have the answer.
And before you answer, if you would just state your name for the record and then answer. Thank you.
Thank you. Carrie Schneider, Research Director at the Office of Higher Education. So you're talking about the deadline on line 31.2, is that correct?
Yes, thank you. Somebody just pointed it out to me. So it's line 31.3 actually on that, but yes.
Yes, so we are proposing changing the deadline to allow the office to know the demand on the state grant program earlier in the fiscal year by moving that deadline to the 30th day of the term, because before it was at the very end of the fiscal year.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you. Okay, so I think currently applications for state grant are due on June 30th, sort of regardless, and they apply to any term, and this would change it to say that basically you have 30 days after the term starts to apply for state grants.
Ms. Schneider.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Coulter. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. And then just one last
question. Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what is the I guess I'm going to ask the question I want to ask. What is the financial effect of that?
Ms. Schneider.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Coulter. This is the one item that I did not have time to do that, but we can get those numbers to you. So.
Okay.
And Representative Coulter will be laying this over.
Yeah.
And then we'll be, Chair Wilgemont and I will be putting together an omnibus bill, and so we will have them back, and they'll have that information. Okay. Or they can also send it to us all.
Yeah, I guess the reason I raise this is because I recall a discussion we had 2 years ago where we pushed out a deadline to apply for financial aid to give folks more time. And I sincerely hope that we are not moving a deadline back, knowing that that means that folks will be leaving more money on the table, because I think that would be, I don't know that that would be a choice I would want to make. So just wanted to raise that. Thank you.
Representative Coulter, that is something that Chair Welgemont and I have talked about. It is on our radar, but thank you for bringing that to light again. Yep. Okay. Any other member questions? Okay. Any closing comments, Commissioner Olson?
Madam Chair, members, only thing I would say is just, again, appreciate the opportunity to be in front of you. I know it was quick work to get the bill introduced, and, you know, hopefully when we're back, it is in the form and shape for further discussion, and we'll make sure we follow up with all member questions that we weren't able to answer directly here today. But just thanks for the opportunity. Look forward to working together.
You have a small but mighty team behind you. And before we let you go, just remind me again how many members you have, or how many staff you have at OHE. Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just shy of 100.
So. Small but mighty, Commissioner Olson. Thank
Probably
you.
Probably looking
much.
At 20% of them here.
Well, the Higher Ed Committee appreciates the work of all the OHE staff and the executives. So thank you so much for being here today, and we are adjourned.